Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Fair Kitchens. Learn about the Fair Kitchens code and join the movement at fairkitchens.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring food for the eyes, how the art and culinary worlds collide.
It's incredibly elaborate. It's a feast for the eyes, a banquet dinner with garnished ham, turkey, and an array of accompaniments.
We shot baguettes with like paint dripping off of them with the blue, white, and red from the French flag.
Oh, what did the student tell me? They said, the camera eats first. And it's so true. It's so true.
Tune in to Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Lindsay Boyd, co-founder of The Laundress, the company that's been elevating laundry with non-toxic detergents since 2004. Since the beginning, Lindsay has been at the helm of sales, marketing, branding, product and scent innovation, and e-commerce initiatives. She's behind brand collaborations and partnerships, as well as building relationships with end consumers and retailers. Last year, The Laundress was sold to Unilever, giving Lindsay and her co-founder, Gwen, the resources they need to expand even further. And last year, Lindsay was named a member of Inc. magazine's 2019 Female Founders 100. I am so psyched you're here.
Thank you. This is
one of those things where everyone knows I do a little bit of like a deep dive of like research. Like I'm writing a paper kind of for like the week before the podcast. And I feel like I have such a great thesis for this paper. I'm so excited to like see if it matches yours. But basically the gist is like, I think you've been ahead of your time for a very long time, understanding the way that consumers interact with their products and kind of, I don't know, sort of setting up what a lifestyle brand, quote unquote, means. Because you've been doing this since 2004.
Yeah, almost 16 years now. Yeah.
And you just, they're like, this whole episode is just going to be like, you were the first people to do this and you were the first people to do that. And so I'm really happy that you're here.
Thank you for having me.
So where'd you grow up? What'd you want to be? I know you started your career in fashion. So obviously that seems to maybe have been a passion of yours.
Yes.
Early on.
That was definitely a passion of mine early on in college and high school, college. But actually, I grew up in upstate New York in Upper Hudson Valley. Mm-hmm. And I am kind of a farm girl, kind of a country girl at heart, with the love for the city, of course. But I always wanted to be a vet, actually.
You are not the first person that has said that.
So completely. Yeah. And my eight-year-old says the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I guess it's just my love for animals, which I still have.
When you were nine, that was like, I'm going to be a vet.
And yes, and very, very, I mean, really up until high school and thinking about, I actually originally went to college to be a marine biologist. So
oh, wow.
It was the science. So thinking about The Laundress now and sort of the science behind it, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. No, at all. I love people's stories because they always fit somehow.
Exactly.
And so did you go, because I know you met Gwen, your co-founder, at this Cornell.
Yes. Like, and at Human Ecology. Yes.
Right.
Textile science.
And was that, did you go to college for that or did
no,
you?
No, I originally went to school for the for sciences and right. for marine biology. And I minored in Spanish.
Right.
And it was like, it's funny how I always tell people, it doesn't matter what you major in college. It just doesn't.
Also, I mean, I was a double major in history and religion. Okay. And I'm not sure what I thought I was going to do with that exactly,
right.
but it was what interested me. It ended up kind of making sense.
Sure.
You know, like it always does. But yeah. So then how did you end up in that textile program?
So I ended up in the textile program. Actually, a friend of mine from growing up was in that program, and it was something I started thinking about taking classes at night in fashion, and I really love design.
After graduation?
No, just in the evening, like during right. college, and
oh,
thinking
wow.
about, and I thought, okay, maybe this whole marine biology science thing is not for me.
Right.
I thought I would be playing with dolphins
yeah.
and swimming with dolphins, but
yeah.
it turns out I'm really just in a lab
in
coat
a, lab.
A lot.
Yeah.
So while I had a real emphasis, so the textile science piece of it was really fascinating to me, and obviously not obviously, but I have a very strong interest in business. And so that kind of just is where I ended up.
Was it a Cornell like separate program?
So it's, well, actually, it's part of the Human Ecology School. So it's a degree.
Right.
Textile Fiber Science is what it's called. That's the department.
So,
and there's an emphasis on either design or business.
Right.
So my business partner, Gwen, had a design emphasis, and
right.
I was more on the sales and business side.
And you guys had an idea for a company even when you were in the program, but then decided not to pursue
yes,
it.
Yes, actually, right out of college, right when we graduated. So Gwen being in design and me having the sales hat or business focus, we had an idea of designing a clothing line. That was really when Scoop, Big Drop, all of
uh-huh.
those stores, you know, that heyday during
yeah.
that time, contemporary fashion was becoming...
Like Intermix, I feel
exactly,
like.
Exactly, exactly, Intermix. And so we thought, okay, great. She had a very good eye with design, so she would design the outfits. I would model and sell them. That was like, that was what we were going to do. That was our
okay.
big idea.
All right.
So after we started designing and thinking about it, we thought, maybe we should get some real experience in corporate
right.
Before we jump into anything.
Right.
So a few years went by, and we had our corporate experience. Gwen was at Ralph Lauren, and I was at Chanel.
And what you were doing, so you were doing the sales business side at Chanel. So, like, what does someone
yes.
do in that job? Like, what,
so,
what
right.
did you do?
Oh, it was such a fabulous job.
Yeah.
I got to go to Paris a lot and go
yeah.
to all the runway shows.
That's kind of
that
amazing.
Was number one.
Yeah.
I actually sold the collection to the Chanel boutiques, as well as stores such as Bergdorf Goodman, Neiman Marcus, Nordstrom. So
right.
we would actually have to train, we'd learn about the collection,
yep.
Learn about the inspiration, learn about the fabrics. It was
mm-hmm.
amazing. You really, you know, really digging deep into the artisanal,
right.
the craftsmanship of Chanel and all of that. And so we would sell to the buyers.
Right.
At these department stores. And then we would also do trunk shows in the stores. So selling to the end consumer.
Right. Okay.
So during that time, actually, I would get a lot of customers saying, how do I care for this jacket?
Right.
Or the dry cleaner's ruining this item. I don't want to buy it. Because,
right.
and they'd say, they weren't worried about the fact that it was
super expensive.
Whatever.
Right.
Yeah. $5,000 right. and up. They were concerned about the dry cleaner.
Well, it's so interesting because if I think about a Chanel jacket, I think about like that like nubby,
mm-hmm.
maybe it has like
tweed,
some sort of like, I don't know, gossamer.
Yeah, like, the lame threading.
Thing going
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
I would definitely not know what to do with that. I mean, and the buttons. So mm. it's kind of amazing that was, because you could have ended up working at Calvin Klein.
Sure.
You know, which
sure.
has other things to get cleaned, but not quite as like troublesome from like a cleaning perspective
right.
as Chanel.
And I actually washed my Chanel jackets. I would throw them in the washing machine. I'd be able to tell my clients that, don't worry, you can wash that. Or actually, you can get that stain out before you bring it to the dry cleaner, because I didn't want to have them at this point in time when we were, before we even had the collection, I didn't want
right.
to tell them to do something when I didn't have the right products.
Right,
to,
right, right.
To really guide them and educate them.
Yeah.
But that was really a big part of the inspiration because I was hand washing a lot of my things at home because I knew from the textile education
that you could.
Amazing. And we were spending a lot of money at the dry cleaner, frankly.
For
we were in our 20s and it was ridiculous. We could spend that money on the sample sale.
So I know that you got like a buying budget when you work at Chanel, but did they also give you a dry cleaning budget or no?
No. So no, it's probably a good thing, actually. Thank you for that.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for that, Chanel. So Gwen was having a similar, you guys stayed friends, you stayed in touch, and you guys were just, were you kind of thinking like, we're going to be in business together, we just have to find the thing? And then you were like, what about cleaning?
Yeah. So we actually, and then we came up with a makeup idea. So we knew, so we started, we got away from clothing and then went into sort of the consumer product world. And we were product junkies. I mean, we both traveled a lot for our previous jobs and went to, and we're finding, we actually ended up buying detergent from all over the world just, to, you know, ultimately as part of our research and to see for different scents and and what was really going on in the market and why was everything blue and why, you know, there's all these materials in this that didn't make sense to us. We're like, why do you need all this? What is all this in the ingredients? And so that was really where we started with that that inspiration to kind of... Well, we were also... To back up a little bit, Gwen was bringing her laundry to New Jersey to wash at her mom's house because we didn't have machines in our building.
Right.
We started a laundry company.
Oh, you did?
Without machines.
Oh, wait.
Funny. We started this line and we were hand washing in our sinks, in our tub, like carrying it to our parents' house to
wash
it. And she was washing cashmere sweaters, a lot of, you know, being at Ralph Lauren, she had a lot of that.
Course.
And again, we knew that dry cleaning, you didn't have to.
Right.
And we were trying to save money, you know.
Yeah,
We didn't have any money right out of college.
Right. No, this is so funny. It's kind of amazing. The whole thing, the entire business was basically bred by necessity every step of the way, which
100%.
I just think is really fun. Okay. So I think... What I read was that it took basically 2 years for you guys to be like, okay, we're doing this, to, okay, now we have a product.
Yes.
Is that about right?
That's correct,
And you were doing research and you kept your day jobs and,
We were moonlighting on the weekends, every single holiday, during lunch hour, you know, faxes back and forth. This was before email, really. Before, you know, we had BlackBerries. There were no iPhones.
Yeah.
I mean, our research was done in the library, making
like
copies
on Nexus
at Staples.
Lexus?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Incredible.
We went back to school for that. I mean, it was... You know, a different, very different time from what it is today.
Did you have a big? Did you know, like how much? Because you obviously came with this like business background. So like, I started something without thinking anything about the market. I didn't even know what the market really meant. I started something without any sort of a like end exit strategic plan of any sort. This is not the sauces. This was the cooking school.
Right.
Like I did not do any of like the real sort of like diligence that someone might want to do when they're launching a thing. So what did you do? What did you not do? And when did you decide, okay, I'm now going to quit my job? Did you already have a product? Was it selling or were you just now going to go produce stuff?
Yeah. So we had a business plan. The thing about Gwen and I, we were self-funded. So we knew before we could take the leap, we had to really have our ducks in a row. Like we couldn't just, we didn't have a trust fund. We didn't have anyone to lean on. We had these coveted jobs in fashion.
Yeah.
I mean,
those were
really hard
jobs.
To get. Yeah. And, but we knew this, we were never getting our boss's job. And we knew we needed, we always had this entrepreneurial spirit and we wanted to do something on our own. So, but we needed a plan. So we did a business plan, a proper business plan, you know, identifying the, you know, challenging ourselves with the idea. And then we put together a list of everyone in our orbit that could possibly help us. Like friends, we've met friends, uncles and uncles of uncle. I mean, it was like anyone. And we didn't say no to anyone.
Right.
I think that's one of the things I tell people when they're starting, like,
yep.
Even if you don't know why you're meeting that person, meet them.
Yep, 100%.
Because you have no idea
what it's going to lead to.
Right.
Yep.
Even if they're, I mean, we met a lawyer who was a painter on the weekends who, it was just like, we had no idea, even he was a partner in the firm and we had no idea why we were meeting him, but a friend of ours told us to meet him and it ended up being one of the best meetings we had.
Right.
So, and we'd laugh about that all the time because we're like, who are we meeting?
Right. You know?
What are we doing?
I'm not sure why.
Yeah. So,
and I'll start meetings off being like, I don't remember who connected us or what we're supposed to be talking about, but you just start and I'll probably be like, oh wait, yeah.
Right. Yes. No, and that's okay. And being a little naive is okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, we were young. I mean, I don't know how it would go now starting it like in my 40s, but, I guess that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
So the business plan was really key. I think getting your ideas down and challenging yourself, but definitely always sticking to your gut and what, you know, the idea, if you're passionate about it, it'll happen.
Yep.
Never waver from that. People are going to tell you, keep your day job.
Yeah.
You're crazy. No one's buying that idea. And people told us that.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, well, it's not for you,
right.
You know, and we just kept moving on. And
right.
I think that's, as long as you have your ideas down and where you're going to, and being able to be forward thinking with it a little bit,
right.
I think, especially now with social media and all the marketing and all the competition that's out there, being able to think about how can I be scalable? Is this a scalable idea? Or is this something that I'm just going to do
and make
for a few years, and that's okay.
Right.
I don't think
you as long
have
as you
to
identify.
Sell to
right.
you know a strategic or I don't
right.
It's just whatever your path is. I think you do need to think ahead.
I think that's the thing. You know, if there, it doesn't have to be scalable. But the thing about like a quote unquote lifestyle business or like something where like you just make you make a little bit of money every year and you eke out. That's fine as long as it remains like good for your lifestyle.
Exactly.
You know, I think some of these businesses are so hard and so taxing and emotional roller coasters that to eke out a little bit of money, if that's the big plan, there are better ways to eke out money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the working for yourself thing can be a little overrated when you're also responsible for a lot of people around you. And
absolutely.
So, I think in here, I do end up sort of talking a lot about, like, I was very much sort of like mission driven and, you know, the big bad money people. But the reality is like, this is the kind of business that to be really successful at, you do need to be able to sell a lot of sauce or jam or, you
definitely.
Know, cookie cutters or laundry detergent.
And actually, to add on to what you're saying, we came to a point in our business, which, you know, ultimately we sold last year, and that was always part of our plan, but we really did hit that roadblock of, okay, being self-funded.
Yep.
Okay, we can only get so much to take us to the next level on our own.
Yep.
What is the path that we need to take and how, and really we got to that point where we could no longer.
Well, you're in like several continents
exactly.
in like dozens of thousands of stores. So you got,
we're a global
far.
Brand. Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Well, we did go really far. And I tell people, you know, we're 16 years old. So we sold at 15 years old. People do start businesses in 5 years and sell faster.
Right.
We were building a brand and building a brand doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
Building a brand that's going to be around like the Chanel's and the Ralph Lauren's of the world. And, you know, I could name a million.
Yep.
But that was what we wanted.
Yep.
So we knew it was going to be a little slower.
Take time.
You know.
And last question before the break. When you did that original business plan, were you taking on Tide and, you know, Downy, or were you taking on dry cleaning? Like, where were you putting yourself?
So, we were taking on dry cleaning.
Right.
We knew that it was really toxic. It was very toxic for you, horrible for the environment, and especially bad for the clothing.
Yeah.
And the best preservation for your item was actually washing it. So for us, it was all about fabric first and really getting people to understand what they're wearing, what their garment is made of, and educating them on not dry cleaning versus going after the grocery store brands.
Right. Fun.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to hear about how you positioned yourself, how you built that brand over the last 16 years, and all of these other fun details. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Fair Kitchens. The food service industry faces a challenge. More people are eating out, yet restaurants are losing talent. Why is this? Research by Fair Kitchens reveals a serious well-being issue within professional kitchens. 74% of chefs are sleep deprived to the point of exhaustion. 63% of chefs feel depressed, and more than half feel pushed to the breaking point. This can't be ignored. Fair Kitchens is a movement based on the belief that a positive kitchen culture makes for a healthier business. By taking the pledge to be a Fair Kitchen, they'll provide you with free information, tools, and resources to help you take action towards making your restaurant more stable, productive, and happy, which positively affects the guest experience. It's time to act now. Learn about the Fair Kitchens code and join the movement at fairkitchens.com.
I'm back with Lindsay Boyd, co-founder of The Laundress. Okay, so it's 2004. You've quit your jobs. You had a product or two?
We had the concept of the products, yes.
But nothing in a bottle yet.
No.
But you knew what you were putting in the bottle.
Yes.
I'm still thinking, it's 2004, and you knew that you weren't selling your product where other products like your product were sold because you knew that it was going to be a different price point and you were never really going to be able to win next to a Downy or a Tide.
Right.
So what did you do next?
So actually, before I left my job, I took my first buying appointment during my lunch hour at Bergdorf Goodman.
So you started pitching it.
Yes, yeah. We pitched it. The idea, basically, we had the pricing, we had images of the concept. We didn't have production. Mm-hmm. We were still, we were self-funded. So that happened after we had the orders. We had to know that this was going to be, this was a viable idea for others as well. Yeah. So I made my first purchase order during my lunch hour.
Amazing. And your pitch was to Bergdorf, just sell it on the counter, sell it like next to the cashmere.
So at the time, the store looks different now, but we were sold in, the pitch was to be in the lingerie department. We wanted to be, so we focused on the delicate wash. So in department stores, it was a very unique experience because everything's divided into sections. So there's not one area where they could, it wasn't one buyer, it was several people we had to work through. So at the time, there was a spot in Wolford's stocking section and the beauty floor. So we had this prime real estate. Yeah. So we were able to showcase all of our products.
Amazing.
So that happened probably after being there for a few months. We were in the lingerie department. We were with some cashmere accessories. And we were also sold in the Chanel ready-to-wear area. Probably not really allowed
to
be
there. Did you just throw some bottles over there and be like,
Actually, I've been known to place product placement in restaurant bathrooms.
That's amazing. Yeah, just like ferreting things out of your like duffel and putting them. Oh, right, exactly.
That looks good there.
But it is interesting. Like, it's just so, it's kind of the way I feel like, and this is a big should, like, things should be where, like, you don't make a product until you know that there's more than just you and your partner that actually think the product is a good idea. Doesn't necessarily mean the whole world needs to, but you do need a customer.
Yes.
So you got your customer, you quit your jobs, and your plan was all high-end, like, find these little
Boutiques, basically. Yeah. And we did a show at the New York Gift Show.
Okay.
Which is where, and Gwen was still at Ralph Lauren at the time, but it was during the weekend and a few weekdays, I think. But so we Yeah, we got our first clients, a lot of our clients during that show as well, like Gracious Home, for instance, a lot of local stores. And then also we just made a list of stores and I called everybody. And
did it come with like a basket? Like, you know what I mean? Like, how do they even know where to put it and how to talk about it? We
set up this sort of opening buy of 13 SKUs and showed how it should be merchandised. I know. And it didn't always work out. You know?
Right. Because that's a lot of SKUs.
It was a lot of SKUs. It was, we had a very high minimum.
Right.
And we only took credit cards. We didn't give term payments.
Amazing.
I learned that early on from someone that was managing a clothing showroom. And she said to me, A friend of mine, she said, if you can get people to give you credit cards versus net 30 or net 60.
Your cash is much
better. So just tell them, no, credit card only.
Right.
After the first, you know, three or four orders, once you establish a relationship with them, then you can give them credit.
Yes.
And that was really the best advice, because the few times that we did give people that, we got burned.
You don't get paid. Well, I mean, so a lot of people think about, and just for founders like listening, like a lot of people think about that as like getting paid or not getting paid. You will eventually get paid, most likely. The issue is your cash flow. So you just, as a general rule, when you're paying, you want the longest terms possible, like push for 60, push for 90.
Absolutely.
If you can. And when you're receiving, you want the shortest terms possible, because, you know, you're putting out money to make a product, and then essentially to wait 2 months or 3 months to like hopefully get paid for that sale, it just puts you in a funny cash position.
Right. So it's tough. We had to buy inventory. And, and then
how are you supposed to do that?
And we had to pay. Right. And if we didn't have, I mean, that was always a struggle.
So you knew that you were not selling in sort of like grocery or drug. You knew that you were focused on high-end boutiques. Mm-hmm. Did you think about sort of like other channels and how you wanted to kind of like attack sales?
So D2C was not as relevant at the time. We did sell online. We had an order form on our website that people faxed in, which is insane.
So you were like early e-commerce.
100%. But we knew that you needed to have, we really wanted a website, because we wanted, when we got into the New York Times or had press, we wanted a place for
people to go
to learn more about the product and the brand.
Yep.
So that we understood. And actually, in the very beginning, one of the biggest investments that we made was into PR, traditional PR. Mm-hmm. So because we knew how powerful that would be for our brand.
Well, I think especially it goes again to, you had this is not a bad thing. It was an expensive product.
Yes.
It was at that point sort of like a luxury product.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't going to be the kind of thing. And my assumption is you had plans at some point to make it a more accessible price point with scale.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for a brand that is basically relying on, you know, you're not going to get your word of mouth at store level, probably. It's going to come from
You know, and the outside. Yes, and actually a lot of how we had to explain the price point and explain the ingredients, because we are an eco brand. Mm-hmm. We're highly concentrated. You only need an eighth of a cup, which is such a small amount, which was so not what people were used to. They were doing a cup, two cups. And also our brand was a lot about, in the beginning it still is, but a lot about education. Mm-hmm. So getting people to understand sort of the how-to piece of it.
Right.
And, you know, we weren't just about, you know, grabbing a product on the grocery store shelf. It was about, okay, why you need the delicate wash, why you need the woolen cashmere shampoo, and how to use it.
Right. It's so funny because, you know, as I said to you before we came in, like, if you think about all of it, right, like, I don't remember what year it was, but I remember like a J. Crew Brands We Love thing. And it was you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, the first brand partnership I had ever seen. I didn't know even what that was, but yeah. It was early.
We were one of the first third brand partnerships in that whole, I'm blanking on what they call it at J.Crew, but we were one of the first people.
I mean, it wasn't even a thing, you know? And so that was early. To what, you know, what they call now like content commerce, which is just like a very fancy way of saying like selling things with, you know, content. Like, I mean, you know what I mean? It's
right.
But in a way, again, it was born of necessity because you were telling a story. Everyone talks about storytelling and like building community. And, but you were telling a story because you kind of had to, right? Because people didn't know exactly what to do with it, which I can relate to very easily with the sauce.
Right.
But I think also in a way, like you were early on the eco thing too. Like you were, you know, now there are all these like amazing innovative companies that are like, we're taking all the water out as if that's, you know.
That's what we,
groundbreaking. I mean, but you did that in 2004.
Yes.
Right. So yeah. I just like, I like this whole, this is my thesis.
Yeah.
You actually started the world. Okay. So, one of the things that also I heard you talk about is like, okay, it wasn't exactly like D2C the way we think about it, but you were early to have a website. You were selling through that website. It was a place for people to land, but most importantly for you, it was really connecting with the people that got the product and understood the product and liked the product. And one of the things I've heard you say is that those, your whole mantra kind of throughout the whole 15, 16 years has been not to try to reach new people all the time, but to really focus in on the people that already know you and love you. And I think that's really good advice and very hard to stick
to. It is very hard. I like get chills when you say that for some reason, because it's like my, that's one of the things that I've worked very hard at. From a sales perspective, because during around 2008, 2009, a lot of the stores were closing. A lot of our original clients, smaller boutiques. And at that time, we were doing the shows and there were no new customers to get. And so we kind of had to pivot a little. We were global very early on. We were in Europe very early.
Asia makes
Asia
a lot of sense,
as well. Yeah. We were in Tokyo very early and Hong Kong, which was incredible for us because we learned a lot very quickly and about our brand and about the different markets. So that was something that we are very fortunate. I always say we're like an octopus because we had lots of...
Yeah, you weren't
we were
all
in a lot of
spot.
Different places. And I think that's really, really, really important for brands and for people starting businesses. You can't just focus, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, it's real.
What they call omnichannel now.
Right. Well, it's so much more complicated than omnichannel, right? It's not just exactly. It's because it's everything. It's marketing, D2C, it's, you know, retail, it's wholesale. But for us, it was, so now I'm like speaking about how we were octopus, but we, I lost my train of thought. So the D2C, I can't remember now. Tell me again.
It'll come
back.
No, it'll come back because I actually, there was something that you just said in there that might trigger it. But you also were early in wanting your own stores.
Yes.
Which for a laundry detergent is an unusual move. I mean, it's just, but if you think about today, people talking about like pop-ups and experiential retail. I mean, now it's so funny. There's a word for everything that you did.
Yes.
But why?
So what, the retail piece of it, having our own stores, we actually started out where we wanted to have a store first and do a service.
Right.
But then we thought, okay, service is not, we're not in the service business. No. We can't do it. We don't know anything about service. What are we doing?
Talk about scalable. I mean, that's not easy to scale.
No.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Right.
And so our store is very new. It's about five years old now. And we do want to, the retail experience was important to us because we wanted a place where you could see everything. Because,
right.
Like you said, 13 SKUs is a lot. Not all of the boutiques could hold our entire collection. We do have stores now like the Container Store in Bloomingdale's where they have a huge display and that's great. But early on, people were like, oh, we can only take 6 SKUs or... So
what were the 13? I mean, just sorry to go back to that, but I mean, I don't have that many different types of
We have
fabrics.
Over 65 products in our line.
Well, but we have, some of them, I'm sure, are the same product with different scents.
We have we have a lot of we have a whole line of accessories and right. sort of lifestyle category.
Right.
So not just and then home cleaning as well.
Right.
Which actually brought some for you today to try.
Thank you. I'm excited.
But actually the 13 SKUs are still today the top selling right. products for us.
Amazing.
But that was all detergents. Home cleaning line happened later on.
Right. What you got chills about?
Yes. So back to the clients. So a lot of those clients were closing, and I thought, okay, there's no new business for us. How are we going to, you know, what's the next step?
Right.
Because the wholesale world is very, very important to a brand starting, and it's still important to us today.
Yep.
Because that's the exposure.
Yep.
There's a convenience too for your customers if you're in there where close to where they live. I mean,
and I think, you know, and I've said this a few times, so listeners know that I feel strongly about this. I think that there was a moment where a lot of brands thought they could circumvent the wholesale business and they could just do D2C. And I think that they're kind of coming up on the reality that it's not that easy to do that. And at some point, you're going to hit a wall that way. People want you where they want you, wherever that is. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, I mean, yes, a lot of things are moving online, but the vast majority, I don't remember the exact, you know, number, but people still buy things in stores, you know?
Yeah, and people like the experience, you
of
know?
Smelling
they,
it.
They want to
yeah.
smell it. And for a product like ours, you want to see it. See how it's being used.
Right.
Like in our stores, we actually, you can come in and bring a stain if you have it and you can try the sweater comb and you can smell and touch and feel. And it's a tactile experience.
Kind of like very early experiential retail.
Yes.
Like I don't know who else was doing that in 2014.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? I actually always say like we did it in reverse. Like we have this experience.
You have such a cool experience.
Represents, but now, like the brand, people will come hopefully to Havens to like know where their sauce came from, as opposed to.
Well, you were early in your experience too. So
yeah, we were just teaching people how to cook. Like I didn't even think of it as like, I didn't think we were selling anything.
Right.
You know what I mean? Now, now we're selling a product, but I mean, we were. Oh, I'm confused about all of it. Okay. So Amazon.
Yes.
Let's talk about Amazon. The way I always kind of divide up like sales channels into a pie.
Okay.
So you had wholesale was the big chunk.
Yeah.
Then you had your e-commerce, which I imagine became more than faxing
our D2C business is one of the biggest growth channels
right.
for us.
Interesting.
Now, so.
And then there's Amazon.
Yeah.
And then I would imagine, there's your own little retail, which is.
We have three, so it's still growing. We plan on opening additional locations. Yeah.
Am I missing anything?
Well, international distribution.
Right. Okay.
We work with different distributors.
Okay.
Which is a whole nother, a whole nother beast.
Yeah. I can't even, my brain can't go there. So Amazon, how did you make sure that they, because when you have a more expensive price point or like, you know, I don't know what we call it, what do you call it? Not expensive. I mean, do we say expensive or do we say like value?
We don't really talk about the price, which is kind of interesting because we speak more about how it's better for our customers want things that are better for them and better for their clothing.
Right.
And when they see the results and hear about the ingredients.
Yep.
And then they have that sort of how-to
right.
or, you know, recipe since we're talking about food,
food
and sauces.
Right, exactly.
But we really did do our how-tos very similar to recipes in
right.
the beginning. That's what people care about.
Right. Then they see the value.
They forget. They sometimes we get how much, you know, price per load, and it's really not that much more per load to a regular grocery store brand.
But on Amazon,
Amazon, so we were really early on as a vendor on Amazon. So we were, so they do, so it's different how it works now, but we're, they send us purchase orders, but a lot of people have shops
right
on Amazon and they, it's, they it's just fulfill. Different. Yeah, right. They just fulfill. So we were able to stabilize the pricing from the very beginning.
So it didn't compete with your own.
Right.
Or they, other
we weren't
stores.
Undercutting. I mean, aside right. from the Prime membership, and there right. are cost savings, but it's not to the point where it's 50% off or
right.
something that hurts our brand and our other.
Are you in any grocery stores?
We are not. No.
That's so funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What about drugstores?
No. Mm-mm. All specialty stores.
Isn't that interesting?
The container stores are most right. mass store that we're in.
Is that part of the Unilever
nope,
plan, that, potentially?
Oh, for, like, to be possibly in, right. like a Whole Foods or right. places like that. Absolutely.
I would even think a Target or something. No. Interesting. So interesting. Okay. So speaking of that.
Never say never.
And the price point and all of it. Like, how did you, you know, how you, 2008 happened. Like,
yes.
As you said, you lost some customers.
Yes.
Basically, people stopped spending money at all.
Right.
You thrived through that period. So how, you must have done something where you shifted the optics away from this is luxury and only for special, and got people to understand that there was value there and that there was something more to it than just like beautiful people with beautiful
right.
clothing.
We
so
did.
How did you
we,
do that?
We did a lot of, so we had to pivot obviously, and we looked at our key stores that were doing really well. Mm-hmm. And how are we going to grow, get them more product, grow more, you know, grow with them.
Yep.
And we focused on sort of like, I don't know, the top 50 or something
yeah.
like that. And a lot of what we do that is so different still today from other consumer product goods is that, or especially in the cleaning space, is that we do a tremendous amount of training and in-store demos.
Mm-hmm.
So I really just loaded up on
which
customer facing. Yes,
yeah.
100%. Customer, I knew how important it was to get in front of the customer and show them how the product worked and why they needed it. And that was it. I mean, it was that easy. Obviously, not right. easy in the sense where that meant a lot of travel expenses on the road, a
right.
lot of time taken, but it was so invaluable. It was so
right.
worth it now thinking back.
And it makes so much sense. I remember speaking to someone whose job basically has been to come in and be the CFO in companies that were great and that aren't doing great. And I was like, well, that's kind of a fun job and also sort of like a little bit intense and kind of depressing. But, and she was like, actually, it's the most fun job. And I was like, well, what, where do you even start? And she was like, you always go back to the core business.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is brands get, or companies get, they get success, like successful. Then they're like, you know what? We're going to also launch this thing. And we're going to also do this thing. And we're going to go here. And we're going to go there. And we're going to open this. And then the reason why they were so great just kind of gets lost.
Yeah.
So basically what you did was you
regrouped. Back to basics.
You went back to basics. You found who was doing your best stuff and you just like went double down on them.
Yeah.
Which arguably we should all be doing anyway.
Like, right.
We should be doing every day that to make sure that we don't run into a problem at some point.
Right. And absolutely. But the reality, right, when you're running a small business, you can't do
– no.
You can't be everywhere. You can't be everything for everyone,
right.
you know? And now that we have a team of 27 and we work with consultants and distributors, we're able to do both. And it's amazing because, you know, we – our original customers are so important to us.
Right.
And they remain, they'll always be important
yeah.
to us. And so we constantly support them while
and
growing the business, while getting new
right.
customers.
So those customers are the stores.
Yes.
They're not the people.
Yeah, sorry, when I'm speaking about customers.
No,
they're
totally fine.
Yeah.
How would you say you support them? I mean, what is it like other than like being in the stores and doing the demos and helping them sell your product, which is arguably a lot of support. What else do you do with them
so
that
we,
shows them that?
We check in with them probably once a quarter.
Right.
Some more than others, depending on their needs and the size of the business. But checking in with them, finding out what's selling, what's not selling, offering to take things back if it's not selling, mm-hmm. Giving them new ways of, you know, helping them with whatever they're doing. You know, find out what they're doing and how they're presenting the product. Offer events to stir interest.
Right.
And we also do a lot on our end to support our stores.
Right.
So we do things like things we love. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do that now, but no one did that when we started it. So we have a people we love, which I'd love to have you featured in. That would be great.
I would love to be loved.
So our things we love is something where, you know, we are a lifestyle brand. So a lot of people want to know what we're eating and what, you know, what recipe we love or what book we're reading and things like that. So that's when we can draw in. So we speak a lot to our stores as well as other partner brands, which we do a lot of.
Could we make like a sauce that stains your clothes that is sold with a detergent that gets it out?
We could do
like Harissa. Actually, our new SKU is kind of stainy.
We could do a little sauce demo in our store.
That would be really fun. Like squeeze the sauce
tasting,
onto a
tasting, and then remove the sauce.
Okay, we're definitely doing that. Okay, let's talk for a second about lifestyle brand, because I don't know that there was such a thing back then. I feel like, again, you were kind of ahead of your time. But also, it's interesting that Unilever would buy a lifestyle brand, because the kind of rule on the street is that they're not looking for platforms, they're looking for products. And that something, so aside from all of this amazing stuff, they clearly saw something. How did that, did they call you one day and they're like, hey, you are looking good to us. Yeah. How did that happen?
So we had actually three different strategics contact us around the same time. So, we're 15 years old. I guess they've been watching us and they have enough experience in this to know.
And you never raised any outside money.
No, we had loans.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, great. Of course. But,
amazing.
No.
So we
did do something early on. We had a soap splash, which I love telling people. We invited it's called the soap splash. It was just a play on detergent and soap. But we had a friend that basically donated his restaurant to us, and I think we paid a small fee for dishwashing or food or something really nominal. We invited every single person we knew, ex-boyfriends from several exes down the road. They all showed up. lots of...
I mean, you're cute.
We were still young. They thought maybe a second time around.
Right, exactly.
We had lots, all family and friends and, friends of family.
Right.
Came and we took donations and we served our idea.
Right.
and we had a couple of friends at the door saying, what would you like to donate for Gwen and Lindsay's company?
You were basically crowdfunding before that was a thing.
Exactly.
Right. That's so funny. I think we have your book. I actually think we just, this is the outline.
I think that your timeline's pretty good.
Yeah. I think also just,
very impressed.
We can just call it, ahead of their time.
Yes.
Or something very,
Yeah.
I'm not good at titles. But I feel like, again.
I can come up with a title.
Okay, you come up with a title. But these are the chapters. These are all the things that you did.
Yes.
When there was no Instagram. And there was no,
we had to be really creative.
Google. Yeah.
We were super creative and... nothing. And I also think, we had to be creative.
Right.
We didn't have, there was nothing to lean on. So we used our, my Chanel jackets as collateral to get a loan, things like that.
Amazing.
We had our 401ks that we you know, yeah. used as yep. an asset. We had really good credit, so we were able to get a lot of credit cards right. to use for the business.
And just quickly back to Unilever, mm-hmm. You had three companies. They were all yeah. interested.
Yes.
And it was because they were looking for
all different reasons.
Right.
Not all the same. Unilever was the perfect partner for us yeah. because their strength and understanding and passion for sustainability
yep.
is and really soap. Ahead of its time too. Yeah. And soap. and seventh generation being yeah. in, you know, our, you know, in our family now, yep. which is incredible because Gwen and I really look to them a lot.
Yep.
Not for branding, but for sustainability and ingredients and efficacy.
Yeah, sure. Like
they were the best.
Yep.
They are the best. And it made sense, you know, for them to partner with us and for us to partner with them.
Right.
It was the perfect marriage. Our brand is all about, especially in fashion, sustainability and
yep.
and understanding that, you know, the movement towards
yep better for the
reusing
planet.
Yep. and not wasting, less fast fashion,
right?
And that added to their
right
portfolio.
Amazing. So. Mm-hmm. All right, do you have a best moment? I know there were many, and this is always hard. Either, okay, I'm going to give you a choice.
Okay.
Last question.
Okay.
Either best moment, uh-huh. like something you just remember being like, okay, this is awesome, or uh-huh. advice that you wish you had gotten that you didn't get, or that you did get. Best advice.
Okay. Best moment. That's a hard question. Which one do you want me to answer?
Either one, whenever you want. Matt's giving me the stink eye. So.
Oh, okay, okay. So advice for others. I really think just get your idea down and stick to your gut instincts and don't waver from it.
Yep.
And it's okay to take a meeting and walk away and be like, I want nothing to do with whatever they just said.
Yeah.
You know? And,
yep.
and still feel good about it, you
yeah.
know? And I think... And don't be afraid to share your idea with people.
Yep.
Because they're not looking to take your idea.
Right.
And it's your idea.
Yeah.
So they can't take it.
Yep. Totally. All right.
Thank you.
Lindsay, this was so much fun.
Thanks, Allison.
I'll give you all my notes.
Okay.
I'll write your book if
Perfect.
You want.
Okay, I love great. That.
Good. We're done.
And I'll eat your
and
sauce.
We'll have a sauce
and we'll
party
have a sauce
and then
party.
Clean the stains.
Okay.
Thank you so much for being
thank
here.
You.
Thank you for coming on. And everyone, I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.